nationales se battent pour les profits produits par les magnifiques communications de vos organisations. Kumbit est une coopérative de travail qui essaye d'aider les petites organisations ou les particuliers à se réapproprier leurs communications par l'hébergement de courriels et de sites web, ainsi que par la création de sites web. Si c'est votre désir, contactez-nous à kumbit.org ou par courriel à info@kumbit.org, kumbit.org. On n'est pas sur Facebook.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Good day. You are listening to the 115th edition of Free City Radio. I'm your host, Stefan Christoff, and the program today is going to be looking at a film, a beautiful film called Our Memory Belongs to Us, which was made by filmmaker Rami Farah. The film looks at these questions: how do you survive, by forgetting or by remembering? This is a write-up on the film, and it continues. This eternal question is still very alive for the three Syrian activists, Yadan, Oday, and Rani. Before the war, they were respectively a law student, a lover of literature, and a volleyball champion. They left Syria, and this film revisits their experiences. They are shared with the director of the film, Rami Farah, and in the context of events in Syria, the three people featured in this film were forced to leave. In 2012, Yadan crossed the border into Jordan, carrying a hard disk containing more than 12,000 videos shot by himself and other citizen journalists in Daraa, the birthplace of the Syrian revolution. In this documentary, the old friends meet again in an empty theater in Paris after a long period of separation. They are on stage in the film, and they share their experiences with the viewers, with the audience, and with the director, Rami Farah, to whom Yadan entrusted his hard disk full of scenes of protest and atrocity in Syria. In this film, the director confronts the three men with their own footage projected on large screens, rekindling their suppressed memories and offering these citizen journalists their say in how Syrian history is presented and how the story of the revolution is told. This film is very striking because it centers the perspectives and reflections of Syrians affected directly in the film, literally in this theater in Paris that is the center of Our Memory Belongs to Us in terms of the filming. In terms of the events that are centered, of course, the protests against structural injustice, against systemic violence, against repression that took place in Syria are the focus of the footage that is projected. This film is a very important centering of Syrian voices in relation to recent events in Syria. Often we hear perspectives about Syria from the outside, and this film challenges that framework and centers Syrian voices. It has been celebrated in numerous festivals and is being screened in Montreal as part of Regarde Syrienne, which is a series of projections that happens once a year. Contemporary Syrian cinema. It's presented by the Regarde Syrienne Collective in collaboration with the Cinémathèque Québécoise. And there's a series of films presented. I'd really encourage you to look up their work. You can find them at lesseriesvousregardent.wordpress.com. And I had the chance to speak with Rami about his film, Our Memory Belongs to Us. And here is our conversation.
Thank you for having me. My name is Rami Farah. I'm a Syrian filmmaker, actor, a dancer, and an activist. In this film, Our Memory Belongs to Us, it's a film about the narrative, about what's happened in Syria and all the revolution, how it started. Because I think the tragedy that the Syrians are living now, it gets misled by the media narratives. For sure, the Syrian regime was trying to put all of this all of this different narrative to deny it or to cancel the narrative of the reality. In this film, Our Memory Belongs to Us, I tried to bring back on stage three of the main activists from the birthplace of the Syrian Revolution, who I knew them since I was in Syria. As an activist in Syria, I was trying to make training for other activists how to use the camera to document them daily lives and what's happening with them. Those Yadan and Uday and Rani and others, Abu Numer, Muhammad Al-Hurani, they were from Daraa. I worked with many different cities from Douma, Damascus countryside, Daraa, Homs, many different cities. But those are the groups that this group, I was keeping in touch with them in the last 11 years till today, trying to live with them, their experience. So when Yadan fled out of Syria at the end of 2012, he entrusted me with this hard drive, which it had 12,756 videos, full of those videos that they filmed it, him and his friends in Daraa. And he said, he told me that you learned us how to film and how to use the camera, but we just filmed our death. We couldn't deliver our voices. Could you deliver our voice? So I was working with Sine Börsörensson, the producer of the film, and Liana Saleh, the producer of the film, and Dima Sabir, the PhD, she is a researcher in Birmingham University. Later on with Gladys Juju, the editor of the film, about how to verify those videos, how we can mapping it. The first departure moment, it was for me to draw a map of Daraa that I was never there before, and to try to put back those elements to the spaces where they belong to. So all the footage that was filmed in Omari Mosque, to put it in the Omari Mosque folder, all the pictures in this way, I mean. Later on, I discovered that there is a timeline for each one of these locations that we can fall on, and we can see what the development of the events, what's happening through this specific location. Later on, I discovered that through the questions of Sine, the producer, which it was the basic questions, who are those people? Why they are doing this? So those people who they were scared from the Sine regime, because they were worried about their families, them families. Because of that, they were obligate to change their voices when they were recording, and to put scarves around their faces when they were in the frame. And so they were anonymous in the meaning of the word. And they were using nicknames, even they were not using their real names. So it was really hard to verify all of these videos, who filmed it, who is in the frame, who was commenting on the videos, and those nicknames, which we know now, no one's of them. For sure, for me, I know all of that details, but I was trying also as a Syrian to hide this information because I was worried about those characters, those people, and their families, them families also. Later on, it was, and for sure also the other perspective that I want you to understand it, that's like to have a Canadian filmmaker coming to Syria and make a film about the Syrian, or what's about the Syrian tragedy, or what's happening in Syria. It was one layer that I was learning in the last 20 years, that we have to give back the narrative to those that they belong to it. So I didn't want to narrate their story, I want them to narrate their own story. So the point of this film, it was how to bring those who they are still alive from those characters who they lived this experience, to gather them again for the first time in a theater in Paris and confront them with their own images that they filmed it for the first time on a big screen in a cinema, in a theater in Paris. So the three survivors of those group, they gathered together and they lived this experience, which it was really violent on them, even on me for sure, to be with them on the stage and live those feelings that they were living. One of the fourth character in the film, his name Abu Nimr Muhammad Al-Masalmi, who he died 18 of January 2013, where the film is ending. I was in contact also with Abu Nimr, and when we started the project, he was one of those characters that I want to introduce him also and to put him in this film. But because now Abu Nimr, he get killed by a sniper from the Syrian regime, so they were 3 plus 1, who is Muhammad Musani Abu Nimr. And we lived this experience together, and we tried to have it as a one film to keep the narrative that we knew already that the Syrian regime trying to deny it and to make a difference with what's happened in Syria. Even through the media, like most of the media trying to talk about Daesh or extremist Islamic groups. But for us as a Syrian, we knew that the Syrian regime, who he was arresting our friends, the artists and the activists, when we were asking to release them from the prison, he released out the most extremist, dangerous people who they created those militias on the ground to liberalize the Syrian revolution as an Islamic revolution or as an Islamic movement. So I wanted to get back to the first 2 years of the Syrian revolution to understand how it started, what and how, where it's landed now. And so because I think most of the people now think or attaching that the Syrian revolution is an Islamic movement, or which for me as a Syrian, it was not like that. This is how Bashar al-Assad labeled it. And this is what the media, most of those videos who they filmed it, it was streamed on mainstream media. But all the time there was a voiceover of a journalist trying to put it in a context that it's fit the agenda of this TV channel, whatever it is. So we thought that in this project, we are giving back the narrative to those who they live this experience and to give them the space to deliver their voices.
In the sense that the multitude of voices that were part of the Syrian revolution, you mentioned the geographies of Dara, of Duma. I mean, there's many locations and people might have heard these names on the news and might have even seen footage or taken some time to watch reports or, you know, some of the documentaries that have shown on Al Jazeera. I think, you know, everything you shared, Rami, and thank you so much for going over that. Often the reality of the ways that the revolution in Syria, the repression, the war, it's removed from Syrian narratives that are not framed simply as victim narratives, right? And I really appreciate your work to think about the ways that film can be a medium to think about resonance and experience that's beyond that very simplistic picture. And, you know, in Canada and in Montreal, there's a lot of people who were following what was happening in Syria and there was a significant amount of support for people who were displaced from Syria. The government made a big deal about it, but it was not really the government that was supporting. It was people, you know, and they could have done a lot more, the Canadian government. All of this to say is, how does film create the opportunity to think about a different narrative? You know, one that centers activist voices and shows the complexity of what happened.
Yeah, I think that's to give back the narrative to those who they lived the experience. It will put us in their shoes, I'm mixing between them and their. In French, it's more clear for me. So to live the experience through the eyes, let's say, of those who they lived it there, and hear them their narrative about what's happened there. It will, and especially in this case of this film, which is happening after 10 years of the revolution happened, it's kind of reflection to understand and to analyze and to understand again what's happened, how much naive we were, what we were thinking that the possibility that we are going through, which kind of traps that the Syrian regime trying to create for us all the time, and we're denied by that. We were not thinking about that because we are not evils as the Syrian regime was. For sure, with the support of all those agendas from many different mainstream medias, what's delivered to the audience all around the world, or for the people all around the world, it's made the people like separated on two parts, I think. Even in Syria by itself, like to create two parts between each family, there is two parts who support the revolution and who they are against or supporting Bashar Assad. Because it was labeled in many different levels, I mean. For me, my mother and my sister are based in Canada. And I do thank the Canadian citizens who they create this opportunity to have those Syrian there, to share with them their life, actually, not just their water and electricity and the gas, which it's not available in Syria now, but to give them option to leave, and the daughters of my sister also. So I appreciate all the people that they were trying to do something for the Syrian. But my question is the reason why all of the Syrians outside is still there. So the criminals outside and the crime is still going on. Are we waiting for, and it's moving now, it's moving. And the legitimacy that Bashar al-Assad having through the last 10 years, which is going to Putin now and what's happening in Ukraine. So it will give us, give other dictators around the world the legitimacy to do whatever they want to do without stopping them. And we are dealing now with the results of those criminals without dealing with the criminals by themselves. And this is different kind of level that I want to rise, I think, in this moment, because the crisis is still happening all around the world. And we now I'm working in an American film in Turkey about refugees also. So those people who they are dying in the sea here, trying to go to Greece all the time, or Mexican trying to go to United States. I mean, like it's all over the world, it's happening. But those are result. It's not the reason. And I think we have to rethink again and again about the reason and to stop the reasons of that, not to handle a couple of victims. They are, we could give them our hands to help them, because the main problem is still there, and it's much bigger than what we think. And it's going on. It's like the snowballs. I don't know. It's going bigger and bigger all the time. It will never stop. I'm afraid that the Syrian who they still live in Syria, like in the first period of the Syrian revolution, people in Daraa went out and broke the statue of Hafez Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad. In the same days when we were filming this in Paris, this film, Our Memory Belongs to Us, the Syrian regime put back the statues to its place in Daraa city, the statues of Hafez Assad. So the new kids who they are going to school in nowadays, they are looking to in the same way that we were fearing to look to this status when we were going to our schools, when we were kids in Syria. So this dictatorship that they were leading our breathing in Syria, it's still there. It's still controlling our, it's labeling our thoughts. It's manipulating us. It was for sure we were living in censorship, in daily censorship, about what we think, about what we say, about what we live, what we see, what we can share, what we cannot share. So this is the main problem, I think. That's the main problem is still there.
In a way, I hope that when people see your film and engage with your work, it will provoke an understanding that there's persisting questions beyond the headlines, right? And Syria has sort of passed from international headlines at the moment. So Rami, thank you so much for taking the time to share a bit about your work.
It's a pleasure for me. Thank you, Stefan, for having me. I appreciate it.
That was a conversation with filmmaker Rami Farah about his film, Our Memory Belongs to Us. It is a very important work that looks at the conditions, the realities in Syria during the mass protests against structural injustice, against the mass imprisonment of people who joined the protests for freedom of expression, for economic justice in Syria, and also against the forced disappearances and the deadly violence that was imposed on popular protest movements and people across Syria. Thank you so much to Rami for taking the time to speak about your film, Our Memory Belongs to Us. I'd really encourage people to look it up and also to look up the work of La Syrie vous regarde, Syria Sees You. It's an annual screening series of contemporary Syrian cinema presented by the Regarde Syrienne Collective in collaboration with the Cinémathèque Québécoise here in Montreal. And their program is taking place in June 2022. Thank you so much to Farah, Vivian, and Mary Ellen for helping facilitate this interview on Free City Radio. And thank you again to Rami for being on the program. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly. We broadcast on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CJLO 1690 a.m. in Montreal at 1 o'clock on Tuesdays, and on CKUW at 8 a.m. on Tuesday mornings in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 Territory, 95.9 FM, and in Kingston, Ontario on CFRC 101.9 FM. That is on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. in Kingston, Ontario. We are available through Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just look us up. You can find this weekly program. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Please look up our archives on soundcloud.com/freecityradio. I will go out with some music from Khayyam Alami, who's a really awesome artist based in London, of the Iraqi diaspora. Beautiful music. I'll go to some works by Khayyam Alami here on Free City Radio, and I'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.
Boom, check it out, you know, it's the boy Dash all the way from Grenada and it's tuned in to C-Cut 90.3 FM.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of March, 2022. I'm your host in Montreal, Stefan Christophe. This is the 102nd edition of the program. And today, in light of events taking place on university campuses around the world, I am going to be featuring an excerpt from an audio documentary, which I recorded in Lebanon within the Palestinian refugee communities. These are communities displaced in both 1948 and 1967 through the Israeli state actions of occupation of historic Palestine. And these are communities that have been affected by the militarization of historic Palestine. It is a series of interviews that I recorded. I'm sharing these interviews within the context of events taking place internationally around Israeli Apartheid Week. This is a series of events that draws attention to human rights abuses being carried out against the Palestinian people within occupied Palestine, but also the more systemic human rights abuses taking place against Palestinian refugee populations around the world. I produced this documentary in collaboration with the electronicintifada.net, and I wanted to share this from the archives this week.
رائف أحمد مسؤول في اللجان الشعبية وعضو في اللجنة الشعبية لمخيم برج الشمالي. هذا المخيم طبعا اللي بقع قرب مدينة صور في جنوب لبنان.
My name is Raif Ahmed and I'm a member of the Popular Committee in Burj al-Shamali refugee camp. This camp is close to the Lebanese city of Sur in southern Lebanon. It was built in 1955 after the expulsion of the Palestinian people from their land in 1948. First they were expelled to the Baalbek region and then they were displaced to Anjar, then to the camps in Sur, including the Burj al-Shamali camp. This is one of the 12 camps that is recognized by the United Nations officially.
ويبعد عن شمال فلسطين ما يقارب ال
We are close to the Lebanese city of Sur, north from Palestine, just 50 to 60 kilometers away. 19,000 people live in the camp, which is 1.3 kilometers square. The UN is present and offers various health and educational services. The PLO is also present in the camp and provides several social services. However, their presence is limited to the decrease in funding directed towards Palestinians living outside of the occupied territories in Palestine after the Oslo Accords.
بعد اتفاق أوسلو والتخفيضات اللي جرت على المساعدة لمنظمة التحرير.
خولة خلف is a community organizer with Beit Atfal Sumud, home of Children of Steadfastness, a Palestinian women's NGO which operates throughout the Palestinian refugee camps of Lebanon. In Burj al-Shamali, Beit Atfal al-Sumud provides Palestinian youth with health and educational services.
My name is Khawla Khalaf. I am working with Beit Atfal al-Sumud organization in Burj al-Shamali camp. The camp is established on 1956. And the population in the camp about 19,000. The situation in the camp is very difficult. The people in the camp suffer from various problems in education, social and health situations. Burj al-Shamali camp is considered as a poor camp because most of the workers, they are working in the fields and as a cleaner in the houses and in hospitals, private hospitals. The workers, they work in the fields, it's like seasonal work. The average of the days per month, about 15 to 20 days only they work. And the salary in this work is very low because the man can get only about $6 and the woman less than $4 every day of working. And as I told you that they can working only between 15 and 20 days per month. Also the people, they are facing many problems. Education, we have in Burj al-Shamali only four schools. to elementary, give elementary education and to elementary and intermediate education. And also the number of the students, about 2,200 students in their in these schools, about 45 or 50 students in each class. And this is a very big number. And the situation, really, the education is very hard. And the lessons, it's very hard for the students. And every year, many students drop out the schools. For our, we start to help the students, and we make like remedial classes for first and second and third elementary classes, because we think that if we support the children in the basic classes, then they can continue their education.
Mahmoud Juma is the director of Bet Tafala Samoud in Borja Shmali refugee camp.
I am Mahmoud Juma. I am living in this camp since long time, and I am from Bet Atfal Samoud Institution. I am the manager of the center in Borj Shamali for this institution, and this camp, Borj Shamali, it's a camp located 3 kilometers in the east of Sur, and the population of this camp, there are around 19,000 Palestinian registered. This camp has a square area. It's about 1.2 kilometer square. The land of this camp was rented by the United Nations, UNRWA, since 1955. They rented the land from the Lebanese government. Most of the families, they are living in very, very bad condition. They are working in the daily job in the collecting the lemon and the banana outside the camp. About 70% of the population of the camp, they are working in this field. From both gender, females and males, they are working in this kind of job. This camp was constructed in 1955 after the resolution of the Lebanese government, when they decided to push the refugees from the borders of Palestine. When they fled outside from Palestine since 1948, they stay a few years close to the borders. Then the Lebanese government, they decided to push them inside Lebanon around the different towns in different places in Lebanon. One of them is Borj Shamali. So how they constructed this camp? Before, the land in the camp, they are filled with some plants and rocks, and the refugees, they start to clean these things. And the UNRWA, United Nations, they give them first the tents to live in it. And also the schools in that date, they are from tents also. And step by step, because the families, they are facing the hard weather in winter, when the weather was raining and around these tents, most of the families, they fled by the water inside the tents. So they decided, the families, to change the situation, and they started to build the walls of the shelters by the zinc, and then the roof, they put the zinc over these shelters. And the Lebanese government also, they refused the Palestinian refugees to put the cement over the ceiling, to make ceiling, because they think if the refugees, they put cement, so they will be a citizen. So all the families, they still suffering from the zinc. I remember that when I am a child, in that date, how the families, they are suffering from this condition. Really, the life in that date is very hard and very difficult. And about the job, because in that date, in 1955 until 1960, the bourgeoisie inside Lebanon, they used the Palestinian to work for long hours in their fields. The workers, they went to the fields at the 4 o'clock in the morning until 4 o'clock at the afternoon. And the salary for the men in the beginning, it's 1.5 lira for the men. And for the woman, it's less than lira in that date. In that date, the dollar, it's equal about 2 lira. So really, the Palestinians, they are suffering from very, very hard condition. Only they are working in this hard job in collecting or digging the ground in these gardens, or collecting the rocks, or to make the asphalt in the streets. It's the hard job with respect to the Palestinian. Really, they are suffering. But maybe the important thing in this, the relation or the social relation between the Palestinian, they are very good in that date between the families. I remember how they are sitting and how they are staying together and how they are close together. If there is one, they are suffering from anything, how you find the relatives and the neighbors, they close to him to help and to support, and they collect money and they collect what they have to help them. They give the hope and the power.
Burj Ishmaeli refugee camp, like all Palestinian refugee camps in the south of Lebanon, experienced the brunt of the 15-year Lebanese civil war and the 1982 Israeli military invasion of Lebanon. Burj Ishmaeli was almost completely destroyed during the Israeli invasion. The majority of the buildings in the camp damaged by Israeli missiles and aerial bombs. Hundreds of thousands of residents of Burj Ishmaeli lost their lives during the Lebanese civil war and Israeli invasion, a fact that was quickly noted by many of the camp residents in conversations while recording this radio documentary.
In 1982, the Israeli military raided the camp with phosphoric bombs, hitting several shelters for youth and children. One shelter that was destroyed was the Holy Kindergarten, in which over 90 people died. Today, this incident is known as the Holi Massacre, one of lesser-known massacres of Palestinians during the Civil War, unlike the September 1982 Sabra and Shatila massacre, in which over 2,500 people lost their lives. In the middle of Burj Ishmaeli, camp residents have constructed a monument to honor the victims of the 1982 Holi Massacre, the names of those who perished carved into stone on the monument. In certain cases, all children within families perished during the massacre. Raif Ahmed, a member of the Popular Committee of Burj Ishmaeli, speaks about the bombing of the camp during the Israeli invasion and the massacre of Al-Houli.
طبعا هذا المخيم تعرض لعدد من المراحل اللي تهجر فيها السكان اثر الحروب والاعتداءات الإسرائيلية اللي تعرض لها هذا المخيم. فتعرض للعديد من الاعتداءات الجوية والبرية والبحرية الإسرائيلية. فتهجر سكانه سنة 78 إثر الاجتياح الإسرائيلي لجنوب لبنان.
This refugee camp has experienced a great deal during the civil war and the Israeli invasion, starting in the early 1970s. After the PLO entered Lebanon, our camp was exposed to many airstrikes from the Israeli military. People began fleeing the camp in the 1970s and massively during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. The camps also experienced a brutal massacres. In 1982, when Israeli warplanes raided the camp with phosphoric bombs, several shelters which housed refugees, mainly women, children, and the elderly who were taking refuge,
الهجوم الإسرائيلي. إضافة إلى هذا
A kindergarten was bombed, called Al-Khuli, and over 100 people were burned to death. Only one or two people survived and remain living proof of the Israeli war crime committed in our camp.
والعديد من الأماكن اللي بالمخيم المغاور
On another occasion, in 1982, Israeli war plans raided another kindergarten called Al-Najdi Kindergarten, which also had become a shelter for civilians. Also, other shelters were bombed in June 1982. This period was the most severe attack that the camp ever experienced. During this period, the camp was exposed to almost complete destruction, as it was estimated that over 90% of the buildings were destroyed, according to UN statistics collected after the Israeli invasion.
Hawla Khalaf, a community organizer with Beta Fala Samud, speaks about the El Khuli massacre.
In 1982, during the Israeli invasion to Lebanon, it was a big massacre in that time. In 7 of June, it's a massacre in El Khuli. El Khuli place was a center for kindergarten, club for youth, and the shelter down. The Israeli the plane make one raid to the shelter, and about 92 people killed in that place. And now it's a memorial in that place to say that this is a shelter and this is a massacre in Burj al-Shamali, and the people who are responsible about this place write all the names of the people who passed in that time. Also, there is three places in the camp, like caves, also destroyed in 82. One in Najdi Kindergarten, one in the end of the camp, and one in the top of the camp. About three caves and one shelter. All about 130 people killed and many missed, and most of the shelters destroyed in 1982.
As Palestinian refugees in Lebanon are prohibited from working in numerous professions and historically have been barred, according to Lebanese law, from working in over 70 professions, unemployment and poverty is a pressing reality facing the residents of the camp. The majority of the camp is unemployed, and families are living on literally dollars a day. Due to this economic situation, many of the camp's residents have been forced to attempt to flee Lebanon to seek asylum in Western European countries and in North America. Mahmoud Juma, the director of Beta Fala Samud in Burj al-Shamali, comments on the deplorable economic situation facing the majority of residents in the camp.
Now, 70% of the families, they are working daily job without any kind of security. The income of the men, they get $6.5 daily. That means if you find the chance to find a job monthly, you couldn't have more than 20 or 22 days or 18 days. It depends upon the situation. So the income of the family, it's less than $200 monthly. This is really the economic situation is very hard, because this, at least, it is not enough for the food of the family. So you find many kind of diseases inside the camp, like the anemia or thalassemia. They coming from this condition,
Hawla Khalaf speaks about the economic crisis facing the majority of Palestinians in Burj al-Shamali.
We have a difficult situation, economic situation, because the Lebanese government don't allow for us to work in many works, many shops in Lebanon, because that we have suffering. And also we live inside camps, and our houses and shelters, it's very small, and suffer from bad situation, and it's not okay to live inside it, because also this, they have many disease every year. for the economic money of people who has professions. They can't work. You can find an engineer is working as a driver. Sometimes you find a doctor work in a private hospital with $200 per month. It's very difficult.
Many families within Bourg-Chemali face extreme poverty, as thousands of camp residents are essentially homeless, residing in makeshift shelters with zinc roofing, without basic plumbing, water supply, and little income. Mahmoud Jama'a from Beit Atfal al-Sumud explains.
And now, in this camp, we have 350 shelters. Really, they are under zinc houses. And these families, they are suffering in winter and in summer. In winter, they put over the zinc a plastic to cover from raining, because there is many, many holes between these zinc. In raining, all the water, they go inside the home. And this make the health of the families, they are really very difficult. And in summer, they reach 50 degrees under the zinc houses. And this is unfair until this moment, how the families, they are suffering.
Within the context of historical political changes facing Lebanon today, Palestinian refugees are questioning their future. Lebanon's political landscape has been a subject of international debate since the February 2005 assassination of the former Prime Minister of Lebanon, the April 2005 withdrawal of over 15,000 Syrian troops from the country, and the ongoing negotiations regarding UN Resolution 1559, which demands that all political groups that are operating within Lebanon that are armed, disarm, including many Palestinian political groups within the camps, such as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, as well as Fatah. Khawla Khalaf from Beit Atfal al-Sumud speaks about the perspective of residents of Bourg al-Shamali about the current political changes taking place in Lebanon.
The future is not clear for all of us. We heard something from Abu Mazen, something from Lebanese government, something from America administration. And the future is not clear for all of us. And they, most of them, they don't know what are happening and what are they cooking for the Palestinian. Are they thinking to give them a new nationality or to give a Lebanese nationality? For whom will give the nationality? And really, it's very difficult for the Palestinian to go now out of Lebanon, to go to Canada or to European countries as a refugees. It's like a new Nakba for the Palestinian. Not because we are leaving Lebanon, no, because we will still as refugees in many, many countries. Because that, I think, it will be like a new Nakba for the refugees in Lebanon.
The right of return for Palestinian refugees displaced in 1948 through the creation of the State of Israel continues to be a central political demand for camp residents. For over 58 years, Palestinians have remained the single largest refugee population in the world, according to the United Nations. Khawla Khalaf speaks on the right of return's relationship to the Palestinian refugee identity and political struggle in Lebanon.
Until now, I can say that Palestine is still alive inside many, many peoples, especially who are in Lebanon, Palestinians who are living in Lebanon. And in Bourg al-Shamali, because we are close to Palestine and we are suffering from many things, we're still thinking about the right of returns. And really, if you ask any child can say, no, I would like to back to my country, to my village, to live there, not to take any nationality or to still live live in the camps, it's like prisons. Really, it's like the prisons. If you pass through the checkpoints, you can see that we are like in the prisons.
This has been the 102nd edition of Free City Radio. I'm your host, Stéphane Christophe in Montreal. I wanted to feature an excerpt of this documentary I worked on Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, in light of the events taking place around campuses globally for Israeli Apartheid Week 2022. Thank you to electronicintifada.net for the support when I worked on this in Lebanon. I'm Stéphane Christophe. This is Free City Radio. We share a new edition every Wednesday. This is the 102nd edition. We broadcast on CKUT at 11 a.m. at 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on Tuesdays, starting in April, on CJLO 1690 AM, and also now on CKUW in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 territory of the Métis people, broadcasting on Tuesday mornings at 8 AM. Thank you so much for being with us. And if you'd like to reach me, I'm at stefan.christoff@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify and iTunes. And I will go out with an excerpt of a recording that I was able to register in Beirut. This is Marcel Khalife playing the oud. I'll talk to you next week and take care.
live, then step us up.
Radio with Widget and my man Pro V.
All the way live from university.
Here, Montreal. On CKUT. Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the Way Live Radio, CKUT 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Thank you very much for tuning in. Going to be playing a whole bunch of different tracks today, nothing in particular. So, you know, from the top, we're going to have some Lord Finesse featuring Grand Poobah, Large Professor, Sadat X, some G.